We're on our 31st episode of Promotion Man.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited and thrilled to have a good friend of mine, Rod Tanner, in the studio with us, because Rod was the local promotion man in the Houston territory when I was transferred from Detroit to Houston.
Gotcha.
It's even kind of uncanny that Bon Scott had recently, they celebrated his passing. And so I had asked Rod when we were talking about this interview, you know, some of the stories that he's going to be able to share with us. And one of them was Bon Scott, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Bon was a good guy, and he and I really connected. It was really fun working with the whole band. These guys were great, and probably, Fred, my favorite band to work with through the years. I must have worked 20 shows with them or more, you know.
Wow. What time are we talking about?
I went to work for Atlantic in 1978.
Okay.
And I think the reason that we bonded was I had only been on the job a month or so, and AC/DC was the very first band that I worked with.
Right.
And it was their first tour to America.
Oh, okay.
So here, they didn't know what the hell was going on, and I didn't know what was going on, so we really got along great.
So I want to ask you about a band that was kind of a regional band when I grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, and they were doing a lot of dates with AC/DC, and they're called Nantucket. I don't know if that name rings a bell to you at all.
Yes, yes.
Wow. So they were from Raleigh, North Carolina. They were signed to Epic. They had a couple of albums out. The big hit was Heartbreaker, and they're still playing today. But again, there's so many pictures they posted of AC/DC during that time. So I was just curious if they did the whole nation with them or not, especially you coming from Houston.
I don't remember. I do remember Nantucket. I don't remember any of the shows offhand with Nantucket.
Okay.
Well, here's the interesting thing is I started at Warner Brothers March 6th, and my very first band was Van Halen. And you start 1978, and your first band is AC/DC.
Yeah.
You guys just dropped right into it. Man.
Right?
That's awesome.
I mean, what a crazy way to begin your career.
Exactly. I had come out of radio. I'd spent 10 years or so in radio at the point. But I had no clue. You know, and as Fred knows, our main priority is getting the records played on the radio stations, which coming out of radio, half the radio stations I called on, I'd worked at. I knew everybody. Everybody knew me. So that was, you know.
Little cheater.
Yeah, it was easy. Yeah, it was like, you know, are you kidding? You're paying me money to do this? Yeah.
And then back in the day, it was still somewhat loose with the format before the consultants really took it over.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You still could get records played. You know, there were not that many. There certainly weren't national consultants in our area.
Yeah, no. And then the beauty, too, was they'd go 2-3 songs deep. So when you delivered them an album, whether it's Dirty Deeds or anything, they would literally go on 2 or 3 tracks.
Right.
All at the same time.
Another thing that endeared me to AC/DC, like I said, they're young, you know, Malcolm and Angus are like 18, 19 years old.
Wow.
They're just kids. It was their first tour here. And basically, they broke out of two markets, Oakland, California, but the first market they broke in, which I had a lot to do with, was San Antonio.
No, I can
San
totally
Antonio
believe that.
Was a huge, you know, hard rock market, much more than Houston or even Austin, you know.
Well, were those guys real partiers? What was the story about that band?
The fun part with those guys, like I said, they were young. They didn't party hardy. They, they would have a beer after a show. They might smoke a joint. And they went to bed fairly early and were ready to go anywhere, do whatever it was that I asked them to do. If, you know, hey, we got to go to the radio station, early morning show, no problem. They were there. Bon, on the other hand, was a little older. Bon liked to rock and roll.
Yeah.
And
did Rod like to rock and roll?
And Rod liked to rock and roll.
So it was a nice combination.
So Bon and I would go close down all the after-hours clubs and whatever into the wee hours of the morning, you know. So Bon and I really, like I said, he was older than they were. He was their limo driver, van driver.
And wow.
In the early days in Australia, and had told him after one of their shows, he said, what y'all guys need is a lead singer. And they said, oh, yeah, well, can you do it? And he said, well, yeah. And they said, yeah, show us. He did. And the next thing is, he was their lead singer. And Bon wrote all the lyrics to all of the material. And Angus and Malcolm wrote the music.
So did Angus have the schoolboy thing already on that first tour, or did that come later?
No, that was on the first tour that I saw. Now, you know, they had been performing in Australia and maybe some in Europe at that time, but this was their first trip to America, and America really didn't know anything about it.
So what was your first thought when you see Angus out there wearing the schoolboy thing and just rocking his ass off? I mean, he's head bobbing and just, you know, ripping on that guitar, but he's wearing a schoolboy outfit.
Exactly. And the very first show that I worked with them was in Corpus Christi, Texas.
Okay.
Had never seen, had never heard their music. I didn't even have an album to listen to even know. I wasn't sure what to expect. And so I'm kind of sitting there like, okay, let's see. And they're the opening band. And all of a sudden they come out, and, you know, about 30 minutes later, I'm a raving AC/DC fanatic because they had such a fabulous live show.
So when I watch them and his head bobbing, I mean, just bob your head for 5 minutes and tell me how you feel.
Exactly.
And he's doing it for an hour and a half.
Well, and in that first show, and I cannot tell you where it was in Corpus, except it was a small place and it had a balcony, like an old theater or something. Mm. But, you know, they go through the whole show and then they took a little kind of break and they come back and all of a sudden you hear Angus. Just there's nobody on stage, but there's guitar playing a little bit. And then the other guys come out and they start kind of picking up the deal. And the next thing you know, here's Angus up in the balcony because, you know, he had the transistor on the guitar so he could go anywhere. He's up in the balcony playing, coming down the aisle, and he's on Bond's shoulders. And Bond carries him all the way back. The crowd goes nuts. I went nuts. Guy's like, oh, my God, you know.
See, that's what I loved about that band. When they brought bagpipes to a rock and roll song, I thought that was like the coolest thing I think I've ever seen.
Absolutely. And their live show was exactly what did it. They toured enough that enough people finally saw them. The way I got airplay on KLOL, KLOL would not touch them.
Really?
No, would not touch them. And I finally went in there and I found a track that I took, and Paul Ryan was the PD at KLOL. I said, Paul, I want you to listen to this. The track was, well, I just went blank.
Of course.
But it wasn't one of their hard rock tracks.
Oh, okay. So it was an easier song, easier for him to digest.
Riff, had a good little riff to it, and it was called... which I'll think of it in a moment. It's another word. But the word was an Australian word they used for the clap.
Oh. Was it the jack?
The jack.
The jack.
She got the jack. Jack.
All right.
Jack.
She got the jack. That's a great song.
So Paul Ryan went, that's
the
great
word and for it, the clap?
For the clap.
I had no idea.
And then it wasn't that real hard rock.
No.
So he could play it. Yeah. They jumped on it. Yeah, and San Antonio started, but they were playing everything, you know.
On a prior episode, we had Mike Easterlin, who was with Elektra. Mm. And obviously, I was with Warner Brothers. So it's pretty thrilling to have you here representing Atlantic, because you had the Rolling Stones, you had Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, the Blues Brothers, Foreigner, Bad Company, Led Zeppelin, The Firm.
Yeah.
So who else do you want to talk about?
Well, another band that I really enjoyed working with was Foreigner.
Yeah.
They
my partner right here, L.A. Lloyd, he digs them.
Well, yeah. Foreigner was a great band. And a lot of people didn't realize, I don't think, at the time, but say 80, 81, 82 in that era, Foreigner sold more albums for Atlantic than any band we had.
Wow.
They outsold everybody.
The Rolling Stones?
Oh, yeah. Rolling Stones never sold that many albums.
They didn't sell more than Led Zeppelin?
Oh, no. Not even close. Wow. Not even close. I mean, they did well, obviously, but their thing was their concerts. You know, and the albums did well, but I'm talking about Bad Company, Foreigner, people like that actually sold more albums than the Stones did.
So tell us a Foreigner story.
Okay, Foreigner, like I said, I'd worked with them quite a few times, and they were very nice to work with, and especially Mick Jones, that's who I...
What is Lou Gramm?
Lou Gramm's on vocals.
Mick Jones.
It was basically Mick's band.
Yeah.
Mick's the lead guitar player.
Which is what it is today. It's basically Mick and some other guys he's hired. Even Lou's not in the band. He does some select dance.
Yeah, and Lou was not particularly well liked by a lot of the promotion people. And a lot of it was...
He was a dick?
Well...
I met Lou. He's nice. What are you talking about,
now,
Fred?
I won't say bad thing.
I don't know.
Lou didn't talk when they were on tour.
Oh.
Which, you know, he's saving his throat.
So I see.
Yeah, so he wouldn't talk. He was very quiet, and that was fine. It was probably pretty good because it seems like when he did talk, he pissed people off. But Mick Jones was one of the nicest guys to work with.
Yeah.
Okay, here's my Foreigner story.
Okay.
So they'd, you know, been out for a couple of years, and so they got a new album coming. I believe it was the Double Vision album. Correct me if I'm wrong. But the first single was Urgent. Okay, I get the single.
That's from Foreigner 4.
All right, Foreigner 4.
Yep.
Okay, so I get the single. And nobody's heard it. We were in the old offices there, Fred, where you and I were together.
Yeah.
So I get the Foreigner single in, and nobody's heard it. You know, and I threw it on the turntable, and I'm back there piddling around. And so it starts out, and it's typical Foreigner. I'm going, oh, man, this is good. You know, I'm doing my work. And right before the chorus, it was like a little riff. It was like, was that a saxophone? I mean, because they're, they're a guitar band.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, okay, fine. And you think about it. And then the lead hits, and there's that great saxophone, and it blew me out of the chair.
Probably one of the best sax
absolutely
on rock and roll. And there's a lot of great sax,
so
of course.
Anyway, at that moment, I knew I couldn't wait until they toured because I had to find out where that came from.
Uh-huh.
Here's this great guitar band. Who came up with the sax, you know? Sure enough, first show after that, you know, I get Mick off in the corner. I said, when I first saw him, and he and I had gotten pretty tight. I'd worked a bunch of shows with him. Very nice. I said, I got to ask you, man, the saxophone. He said, let me tell you the story. I said, great.
Okay.
He said, we were recording at the New York studios. We had the whole song done. He said, I had played every lead I could think of, and nothing worked. We couldn't think of anything. He said, I didn't know what to do. He said, we'd worked on it for hours. It's late at night. It's 11 o'clock. Everybody's kind of taking a break. I'm looking at a newspaper or whatever, and I see where Junior Walker is playing down the street.
Shut up.
In a little club. He grabs either Ed, the bass player, or somebody, and says, come on, we're going down. So they go down, talk their way into this club. Finally talked their way backstage, and Junior Walker doesn't have a clue who they are.
Yeah.
You know? He said, it took us 30 minutes to convince him we're a real rock and roll band, we're recording, we'd like blah, blah, blah. So after the gig, he comes back to the studio with them, and they play the track and tell him kind of what they want. Well, Junior has been just playing old jazz stuff for the last 5 or 6 years. You know, his rock and roll stuff was years ago.
Yeah.
And he couldn't get there. And he said it took him about 2 hours for him to get loosened up. And then finally, when he finally got into it, got connected, that's what you hear. So that's that's the saxophone player is Junior Walker.
And I got to tell you, I don't know who did it first. It might have been Foreigner. But, you know, once that song had that saxophone and Urgent was such a huge hit on the radio, I started hearing saxophone on every 80s song that came out after that.
I think a lot of people did the same thing. And, you know, if you remember the early days of rock and roll, everybody had a saxophone.
Yeah, in the early days. And, of course, Bruce Springsteen really made saxophone important.
He made it Clarence
sexy. Clarence Clemons. Yeah.
Exactly.
There's L.A. Lloyd right there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I remember the Stones bringing Bobby Keys in early on.
Yeah.
It's just such a beautiful instrument, and I think it blends so beautifully in rock and roll when it's done right.
So let me ask you this. After coming off a great song like Urgent, and, you know, it's a rock band, Foreigner's killing it, and then you go like, hey, Mr. Heavy San Antonio Black T-shirt Capital of the World, I've got a little song here called Waiting for a Girl Like You.
Yeah.
So how did you handle playing that really amazing ballad from this amazing rock band?
Well, and I think at that point was just because Foreigner had established such a following. They sold so many records that whatever you stuck on the radio and said, this is from Foreigner.
Yeah, they arrived.
They arrived. They had arrived.
Oh, it was a huge hit. I mean, but it was probably, I would say, their biggest crossover hit ever. Because, I mean, it didn't matter what format you were.
Exactly.
You were playing that song.
Exactly. It was a great song.
Yeah.
It was a great song. And I think it's because they were a great band. And they had great radio hits. That goes back to why they sold so many albums. Because they got so much radio play across the spectrum.
We had just talked about that in an episode where we were breaking out the charts. And we were talking about why Foreigner stayed at number 5 weeks, months after months after months. And it was because of the airplay, not at just rock and roll, but at Top 40 and AC and all of that.
You take bands that the album stations wanted to play, you know, and especially the early days, they didn't want to play a single because that was top 40.
Right.
They wouldn't touch it. You know, they're just playing the album tracks. Here you have a band that gets that airplay across the board, and a lot of people were either top 40 or they were album play. They didn't cross over that much, you know.
Well, you could get Cold as Ice from one station. Oh. You could get Dirty White Boy from the album rock station.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So you worked with the Rolling Stones. Just give us one of your favorite shows that they had done when you were with them, and what, if you can remember what album it was.
The best show I ever, and I only worked about four shows with the Stones. They were obviously big enough that I'm the little local guy. I didn't have much to do with them. And they basically had their own label. We just distributed it. So Rolling Stone people, they had their people there. But the head of Rolling Stone label was a really nice guy, and he and I kind of hit it off, so I got to kind of run with him. So, no, I can't tell you any great stories about Mick and Keith, just that I got to be in the room with them occasionally. Mm-hmm. And one of the most fun times I ever had was a show they did at the Superdome in Louisiana. And it was the biggest backstage I had ever been involved in. There were probably 200 people backstage. That's how big the backstage was. It had a full-tip, huge walk-up bar, two bartenders.
Wow.
And it was all celebrities. It was the Playmate of the Month was standing next door to me. You know, there was, you know,
Football coaches, baseball stars, players.
Yeah, all of that stuff. And there was a little guy that sat right behind the curtain of the backstage, and all he did was roll
Joints.
For Keith. That was his job. He had a little pan there, and he was rolling away, and he had all the smokes here. And when Keith, you know, would duck back, he'd hand him one. So if you'll, you know, you've never seen Keith on stage without a cigarette in his mouth. Right. Well, you know.
The thing I wanted to talk about Some Girls was the album cover, because you could pull it out and maybe talk about the album cover from Some Girls.
I can barely remember. I'd forgotten the name.
Well,
of it. Yes,
but it was Andy Warhol, and there was, I think, seven promotional copies.
But you could pull the sleeve out and turn it around.
So it was a die. It was a die cut album cover.
That I don't know if anybody had done that before.
And the sleeve. Well, but think about the Rolling Stones. Sticky Fingers had the zipper.
Right.
You know, Alice Cooper, Schools Out had the underwear, panties.
Right. Yeah.
So they would push the envelope if they could.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a band like the Rolling Stones could push anything they wanted.
Yeah. Right.
I was with Virgin Records for 8 years,
yes.
So I had the Stones with them as well. But when I talk to L.A. Lloyd and some guests, every now and then they'll bring up when I dressed up as a pope to promote Lenny Kravitz. And one of the things that Rod did that I thought was so badass, it was the Blues Brothers. You want to tell us what you did?
The Blues Brothers was cool because at the time, the first album hadn't really come out. I mean, it was finished and done, and we were fixing to take it to radio. That's what it was. And at the time, they were shooting the Blues Brothers movie in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So what Atlantic did was they had a little contest with all the promotion people, and whoever won in their area got to go to Chicago. And so we didn't really know very much about the movie at all. I mean, obviously we knew what they dressed like because we'd seen them on TV, and there was something on the album cover. We knew the black hat, the suits, all that stuff, the sunglasses. But we didn't know about the police cars and all of that stuff. And I went down to Rent-A-Wreck and rented an old big Lincoln Continental.
It was badass. It was a Lincoln Continental.
It
had the suicide doors, so it was like a 66 or 67 Lincoln. Oh, so bad. It was a convertible.
Exactly.
Because I think you asked me if I wanted to go with you,
and I jumped in
and went with you.
And Todd was the other blues.
Todd Galley?
Todd Galley was the other blues. So we put our black hats on. We put our sunglasses on.
So funny.
Well, what happened, the cool part
is, we have buttons. We had these buttons that was either John Belushi or Dan Aykroyd, just black and white with their hats and ties.
So I pull down. We go down to KLOL. And it was on Lovett there, and I had the boulevard.
Boulevard.
Well, I wheeled in there and drove up on the boulevard in the old car. Well, a police car comes around the corner about that time. It's like, oh, my God.
This is perfect. Turn on the lights and get some pictures.
Well, no, we didn't need to be arrested for numerous reasons.
Oh, you were holding.
A little bit.
Oh, wow.
So they pull up, you know, and it's two cops. And the guy gets out, and I said, look. And so I explained to him what to do. And I had the album, and, you know, the radio station's right here. Well, immediately, they got into it. So I'd had Bruce with me to take the pictures.
Oh, Bruce Kessler.
So the pictures I got with the car, me and Todd, are with two policemen.
That's so great.
So that's why I won the contest.
You did win.
Yeah, so I won.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Got to go to Chicago.
That's brilliant.
And so that was the first time I got to meet Dan and Belushi. Dan is exactly like, he's just this very high, very, very serious. All yeah. Belushi's exactly like he expected to be. He's just off the wall. He was nuts. But the minute we walked in, and somebody said, and this is Rod Tanner, said, you're in Houston. He knew everything about me, everything about, so in other words, Jim, I mean, Belushi was very attuned to what was going on with that album,
wow,
the
great
airplay, everything. It, you know, blew me away. He knew exactly what was happening. And then I got to do two shows, I think, on the tour. But then after I'd met them in Chicago, so when they came to Houston, man, you know, I'm backstage with them and brought John Long and a bunch of the PDs.
Oh, I remember John Long.
Superstar, and Belushi's just acting like he and I are old buddies.
That's so great.
I've got my girlfriend, Marilisa's with me, and he's hugging her and all this stuff. Well, I was like the best guy on the planet at that point, you know.
So I have to tell you, Lloyd, when I got to Houston from Detroit, I'm, you know, 6'4", I weigh about 180 pounds.
Yeah.
And I've got a head of curly hair that I could be the shrub in someone's front yard.
Yeah.
And I hit the ground running because this job was a promotion. It was a bigger territory. I wanted to make my mark. So I was just like absolutely doing everything I could to get every single record. And I was just full steam ahead. So every Monday when we visited radio, we'd meet and do a happy hour sometimes where all the record guys would get together, and we had like a lunch. So all of a sudden, all eyes are on me, and I think it was you, Rod, that said, Fred, we need to talk. We need to have a conversation.
We need to have a talk.
Yeah, we need to have a talk. And I go, well, what's up? And he goes, we want you. We've all decided. We've made a vote that you need to eat a Valium every morning with your coffee because you need to calm the down.
Fred was a little too eager in his gig.
Wow.
You know, well, a number of us
these guys would take naps in the afternoon.
Yeah, you know, it was like, look, this is an easy gig. You know,
don't
you don't have
so
to get
seriously
carried away.
Give
have
him a joint, for
it,
God's
you know
sake.
Yeah. Well, do you remember where my second office was? It was Baxter's, the little bar down there where yes I had my own phone.
Yes, he had his own phone.
I had,
wow, in the back of a bar.
I had him put in the phone line. I knew the guy on the bar. And so when I came in, the bartender would pick up my phone, set it on bar. I would go to my table, plug it into, and that's where I worked from, was
that's
this bar.
Awesome.
And Atlanta, New York knew that because I told them. I said, if you need to get a hold of me, this is where I'm at. You know, and they said, okay. Well, I was having a problem about 2 years in with they changed one of the upper echelon in New York.
Oh, wait, Atlantic?
At okay Atlantic. And he was really on my case about paperwork and reports and all this stuff, which I did nothing. I did none. Zero.
Expense report? What the hell are you
well
talking about?
Well, those. Yeah. Those we get money.
Yeah.
That's
yeah
creative writing, no, and you fill in all the squares.
Oh, you did that every week.
That
no
was a blast.
But this is our, and it's like, look at the, you know, you've got all the radio station lists. You know what records I've got played, blah, 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 blah. I don't need it. You're just covering your ass, so don't bother me. The guy that hired me, Vince Ferraci, who was a terror to everybody, but just treated me great for whatever reason. And Lou, the guy that was just about to, wanted to fire me, went into Vince. I didn't know this till later, but I went into Vince and said, you know, I'm, you know, he just won't do his reports. I'm going to fire him.
Oh, was he Lou Sicarera
yeah
or something?
Lou
something
Sicarera
like
out of Cleveland, I think.
That's right. I remember that guy. Like
so
a gangster.
Vince said, I tell you what, why don't you go to Houston, spend 3 or 4 days, week as long as you want to with Rod, and come back, and if you want to fire him, I'll talk to you about it. So Luke, you know, so, and I knew Luke's coming down. You know, he called, I'm coming down, you know. So, and I'm pretty, so my first thought is I could just really jack with him. And I said, no, I'm not, you know. And so I did exactly what I always do, and we ended up at Baxter's at my bar.
With
you
your
know,
phone.
With my phone. We went to the different radio stations. He left, went back to New York after 4 days. He goes into Vince's office, and Vince said, what do you think? And he said, he may be the best guy we've got. So I said, okay. Because
oh
that's
God
the way I treated the job.
Do you remember a guy named Ronnie Counts?
Oh, yeah.
So Ronnie was your counterpart in Detroit.
Exactly.
And he just loved Quaaludes, loved them. He'd eat those things. So he'd get so f***ed up, I would have to take his keys and chuck them, you know, down the driveway or not the parking lot. Because he couldn't drive. But I love that guy.
Ronnie was fun. I only knew him because it's the convention and different regional things that we all went to,
R&R
or something like that. Ronnie would be there. So, yes, I was around Ronnie and a fun guy,
Guy. Yeah. So what about the Firm or Bad Company or Led Zeppelin? Any stories there?
Okay, I didn't get to work with Zeppelin because the very first year I go to work is when Bonham died.
The album
Into the Outdoor had just come out, and I just couldn't wait. And then Bonham dies, no tour.
No, nothing.
And we get Coda.
Yeah. Which was a real stiff, wasn't it?
Well, it had All My Love on there.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Did have that one.
So, but I did get to work with Page because I got to work with him with the Firm.
Oh, okay.
Right, that's right.
And something else.
Radioactive.
And I had heard all these stories about Page and Jimmy Vai, and he was one of the nicest guys. Couldn't have been nicer. Was very easy to be with.
Like an English gentleman?
Yes. You know, he and Paul Rogers put together the Firm, and that kind of was easy to work with. I'll tell you another guy that I worked with a lot that was very easy to work with was Phil Collins.
Oh, wow. Phil. And Phil was pretty incredible.
Huge artist for Atlantic.
Huge. And nobody thought that was going to happen.
And you had Genesis and Phil Collins.
Yes.
So Genesis you had them first. Both.
Well, I never worked with Genesis.
Not Abacab or anything like that?
Mm-mm. I worked with Peter Gabriel later.
Okay.
But I didn't work with Genesis.
Because I worked with Peter Gabriel later as well.
Mm-hmm.
But so tell us about Phil Collins.
Well, I got to tell you, the first thing about Phil Collins that stands out is that album Face Value and that close-up of his face. I mean, it's like when you see it on the shelf in a record store, it's like it immediately jumps out at
you. And I was such a rock and roller. It wasn't that I was bowled over by his music when I first heard him, but I was obviously impressed with how much airplay we got and how easy it was.
Can I ask you a question about that song? Did it do well on its own before it was played in Miami Vice or after? Because it seemed like once I heard that song in Miami Vice, and Miami Vice was making hits back in the day because it was such a popular show. But, I mean, that song was probably what I always remember Miami Vice as, this great scene, and all of a sudden In the Air Tonight's playing, and Don Johnson, Sonny Crockett's cruising in his black vet, and this song is played. I mean, it to me, just that's my memory of that song.
It really kicked it in, but I have to tell you, it was doing very well before that.
Yeah, okay.
And it was because of that hook that came so late in the song.
Right, right.
You know, that's what blew everybody away was generally you put the hook in the middle or up front.
Yeah.
That's the hook. And so that's what made it such a great hook because it came out of nowhere.
Yeah, and of course, there's that drum that everybody air drums to. Da 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 da.
Absolutely.
Oh my God, that's the most famous drum part ever.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think at first, it was a slow taking off, but it took it a while, and it was because that hook was late. But then once it got going, it really kicked in.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I think the Miami Vice thing just was icing on the cake. I mean, it really. It really went after that.
Yeah.
Well, I have to tell you, I had a chance to read Phil Collins' book, and it was an extremely interesting book. And obviously, when you read these autobiographies, you learn a lot about the character. And he even said, I got sick of myself. He said, I was so famous, and everything I put out was going to the top of the charts. And he said, it just was too much. And one of the other things that I found fascinating about Phil was for whatever reason, he got very engaged in artifacts from the Alamo.
Yeah.
And became one of the largest collectors of Alamo artifacts that he even dedicated and donated his whole collection back to the Alamo Society in San Antonio, which is kind of wild for a drummer from England.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. True. Phil was a very introverted person.
Very.
Okay. And a lot of musicians are. Mm-hmm. A lot of actors are. They're very introverted. And you put them on stage, they're okay. Look at his early career. He was a drummer. He wasn't out front. Even though he sang, he was not out front. Being out front now, being the star, he didn't like it particularly. I mean, he did and didn't.
Well, actually, he didn't, which is what it drove him to become a hardcore alcoholic. He blew through several marriages mm-hmm. and and then had to kind of find his way back.
Exactly. Are you talking about me or him?
Yeah, wait a minute.
Okay, so speaking about books, my buddy Rod Tanner has written two books.
Wow.
His first one, I'm going to brag a little bit.
Okay, go ahead.
His first one was on the number one bestseller on Amazon for a week.
That's great.
And you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the first book is called Surge. The concept or the center point of the book, it's fiction, is a Category 5 hurricane hitting Houston Galveston area dead on, which has actually never happened.
Mm-hmm.
The way it came about, I had been writing a number of things, articles, whatever. A good friend of mine at that time was the general manager of the big marina in Kima. And so every year they had to go through their hurricane preparedness and all this stuff. And the weather people came out and they did a little training thing for all the people. So we were having lunch one day and he said, "You need to write a book about hurricanes." And I'm going, "I have absolutely no interest in writing a book about a hurricane. Hey, because I don't know anything about them, blah, blah, blah." He said, "But would you please just come talk to the weather people?" He had met them. They were very nice. So I did. So the National Weather People had an office there in Houston. I met with them, and they said, "You know, our problem is the apathy," which I was that guy they were talking about. He said, "If we oversell a big storm or something, nothing happens. You know, everybody's all pissed off because nothing happened. If we undersell it, people get killed. They're pissed off because we didn't sell it." So, you know, they were very nice, and the more I thought about it, I finally decided when I came up with a concept for the book and just have the hurricane in there, then maybe I can do this. So I spent 4 years writing it.
Wow.
And most of the research was done on getting all the hurricane stuff right.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed the emergency manager people, everybody involved with hurricanes, how they work, which they don't know, all kinds of stuff. And then once I felt comfortable that I had the actual hurricane stuff right, I thought I had some characters to tell the story, and that's basically what it is about. And so I got very lucky. It was released on opening season of Hurricane June 1st of 2004. I actually sold some books, did a little business. I'd called all of my radio buddies. "Hey, can I do an interview?" "I got a book."
I'm about to do that myself.
And a couple other people had some articles in the paper. So I was doing a little bit of business. Then the next year, 2005, Katrina hits New Orleans.
Wow.
And everybody sat there in front of their TV and watched that catastrophe.
Wow.
A month later, Rita's sitting out in the Gulf about to come into Houston.
Yeah.
And it's a Category 5 sitting out there. Well, my phone's ringing off the hook by this time, and I had a huge article in the Houston Chronicle. So it really kicked in. I did a bunch of interviews. I was doing all kinds of stuff. We were going to, and so the hurricane is supposed to come in the next day or something.
You were going to evacuate.
Yeah, we were going to go to Lufkin, where my mother-in-law lives. She wanted us to come up there. Now, I had done enough research for 4 years. I knew where I lived in Houston, we're probably going to be okay, but she wanted us to come up, fine, we'll come up, blah, blah, blah. So that morning, I had two interviews. I go do them. I told Diana, I said, "You know, we'll leave when I get home." Got home, car's packed, and I said, "Well, let me run check my email." I go check my email, and I had an email from MSNBC. He said, "We want to interview you live tonight on television."
Wow.
I would stay. I would do the interview.
So I go back out to the car and I tell Dad, I said, "We're staying here because we're going to sell some books."
Nice.
We've covered a lot today, man. I mean, how did we get this all in less than 40 minutes? I'm really impressed, man. What a great guest, and glad you found him.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming in.
I thank you very much. I've enjoyed it immensely. And it's so good to see you again after all of these years.
I'm eating Valium every morning.
I haven't had a drink in 30 years, so I'm doing very well, too. So,
yeah,
I'll tell you one last story.
Okay.
Because you're involved.
Oh, I am?
One day, because you know how Herschel and I ran together. Herschel was the epic guy, and we ran on the road the time.
So Herschel Orr was Rod Tanner's best friend.
Absolutely.
And he worked for Epic Records, which had their own slew of major bands.
Yeah.
And was the biggest, the enemy of WIA or Warner Brothers or whatever, was CBS. Herschel and I always ran together. So one day we're going to lunch, and you were at the office. I was fixing to go meet Herschel, And I said, I asked you, I said, do you want to go to lunch? And you said, yes, but I asked to stop at Louis Messina's office. ZZ Top was coming to town. So we go up to Louis, and of course, Herschel and I both know Louis. I mean, Louis was a great guy.
He's a great
he
guy.
He really was fun to
he
work with.
He lives here, and I'd love to hook up with him.
Man. So anyway, Herschel and I are sitting on the couch, and you're sitting in front of, because you're, but the problem is, Louis's on the phone with Bill Hamm.
ZZ, who's the manager of ZZ Top.
Right.
They're in Europe at the time. Now, this is when ZZ was going to do the summit for 3 days, which nobody had ever done 3 days in a row. And so they're on the phone, and he's got Bill on the speaker so we can hear everything. We're just sitting there, and they're discussing all these percentages and all this stuff. And Herschel and I are thinking, and I don't know what you were thinking, but we're just thinking they're hashing out this third show, because they'd set to, and we're thinking they're working on how much money for the third or percentage, blah, blah, blah. No, they were talking about T-shirts, the concession.
Right.
Because in those arenas, you know, different places that you play, you make and bring your stuff in, sell it yourself. Most of the big arenas, you just gave it to their concessionaire because they had the concession, and then they paid you a percentage.
Got it.
So this is what they were talking about. So we go to lunch. And Herschel and I are going, we need to be in the T-shirt business. Okay? So we got into the T-shirt business.
Nice.
So this is the year. Herschel was a huge Oiler fan. I was a Cowboy fan. I could care less about the Oilers. But they had just traded for Kenny Stabler from Oakland. Mm. And boy, and they had Earl Campbell. This is going to be his second year. So they got Kenny Stabler and Earl Campbell. Everybody's thinking, this is the year they're going to go to the Super Bowl. So we're sitting around thinking, all right, we came up with a T-shirt, which we couldn't get away with today because the NFL would have shut us down the heartbeat. It was the
Oilers.
Yeah, Love You Blue, blue.
Yeah.
Had an oil derrick. Had a rose that grew up through the oil derrick. And a snake that came around it was over the top of the rose.
Tyler Rose for...
And the snake for
wow.
Kenny Stabler.
And the snake for Stabler.
Okay. Now, down here, underneath it, well, at the top, it said the super formula, you know, curved over. And at the bottom, just like the Roman numerals on the jerseys and whatever, it had Kenny Stabler's number plus Earl Campbell's number equals, and it had the Super Bowl, which is in Roman numerals, whatever it was that year.
Yeah, yeah.
That was it. Now, if you weren't a football fan or an Oiler fan, you'd look at it and not know what it meant.
Right.
But if you were an Oiler fan, you knew exactly what it meant.
Yeah.
Our first order was at Stop and Go, and they bought 258 dozen.
Wow. Holy cow.
Dozen. So, wow.
My next door neighbor, a really cool guy, black guy, and he called on hospitals, and I knew he was a big Oiler fan. Not too long after we got going, I go over next door, and I held up the, I said, what do you think about this T-shirt? Oh, my God, I love that, you know. I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I'll sell them to you all day for $5, and then you sell them for
whatever
what you
want.
Can get.
Right.
He would show up about every other week and get at least two dozen, 12 or more, five or six dozen. And a good friend of ours, remember Mark Niederhauser?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mark had just lost his job. So we put Mark to selling our T-shirt. We kept him alive for a couple of months. And still to this day, when Mark goes, man, you and Herschel, y'all took care of me. I have no idea how much money we made because we spent over dime. I know we bought that big old boat and a whole bunch of stuff. And we knew it was a one-shot deal. In other words,
so
they're either going to go to the Super Bowl or not. This is the year. This is not a long-lasting deal.
Right. You got to get it while you can.
Yeah, well,
I didn't know Rod, that. Rod, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it
this
so much.
This is a blast.
Okay.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.